I will try to tell you, well, not exactly what will happen next, but how things happen next.
Coming to you from the many worlds of the multiverse.
It's the podcast that's never the same twice, and always two things at once. This is Burning Man Live.
Welcome to the show. I'm Andy Grace, your host for today's episode of Burning Man Live. Thanks for being here. If you've listened to our first few episodes, you probably know this is the point in the show where usually we wax philosophical for about 5 minutes on the subject of today's podcast, sharing our own thoughts about various aspects or principles of Burning Man. But today, I'm not going to do that, at least not for very long. See, radical inclusion is built into Burning Man's DNA. But that's not the same as saying that Burning Man spaces have always succeeded at being, capital R, radically inclusive, especially when it comes to racial diversity. In fact, it would be fair to say that despite the historical presence of some burners who are Black, Indigenous, or people of color throughout our history, Black Rock City and other Burning Man spaces, well, if you've been there since day one, I doubt anyone would say Black Rock City has ever looked like the rest of the world when it comes to diversity. In fact, our 2018 census in Black Rock City said that only about 1% of burners present identified as Black. As a community, we've been discussing this for years. As our popularity has grown, more people have come to the table to take part in this dialogue, and more Black, Indigenous, and people of color have arrived to join the creative community and lend their voices to the conversation. Inside the organization, the project has leaned into this discussion over the years, too, working to dig out and acknowledge our blind spots and recognize our responsibility and the need for communal effort in this department. It's an ongoing process, to say the least. Roundtables, trainings, a series on the journal. These are some of the actions that we've taken to move to address this topic in a more concerted and constructive way. Where perhaps we used to say radical inclusion already means everybody's welcomed, I've witnessed both up close and from afar this acknowledgement that being open to all doesn't always translate into being welcoming to all. These days, I think there's a general openness in our community to do some of the harder work of anti-racism. But as anyone will tell you, it is work. It's a civic responsibility. With that work, in 2020, one lesson is bubbling to the surface. We are seeing a surge of activism and coverage and the conversation about racial injustice that's embedded into the DNA of the United States of America itself. I'll tell you what I think that lesson is after a word from this week's sponsor.
Obviously, here at Burning Man Live, we love podcasts. And you're listening, so you probably love podcasts too. Well, if you've enjoyed the many twists and turns that have happened in this season of Burning Man Live, then you'll definitely want to check out our sister podcast, Communal Effort. What makes Communal Effort special is that it's not just a podcast. It's more of a platform. It's a cutting-edge, fully immersive, interactive experience, and you have to try it. Let me tell you about this season. You are not going to believe where Communal Effort goes. It starts with the protagonists. Who are you, right? I bet you didn't see that coming. It starts with you personally wanting to do something. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it's one of those plot twists that's really shocking, but also kind of what you always knew you wanted to do all along. So you want to do something, but then you get your friends, who are played by your actual friends. That's kind of amazing, to help. You all come together to work on this, and then the project gets bigger because people are offering new ideas, and it gets more and more dramatic. It kind of takes over your life. And then, I swear to God, these people you don't even know show up. And what do you do when that happens? Okay, well, spoiler alert, they help too. Things really take off. And suddenly, it's not just your story. It's everyone's story. It's grown and taken on a life of its own. And it's got celebrity cameos. I'm actually in this too, because I'm the one telling you about Communal Effort right now. That's how you heard about it. But okay, that's just a small cameo part. The important thing is that you and your friends and people you've met through doing this good work have all come together to do something that supports everyone. And that creates its connections. And we're only a few episodes in, but your life has already started to change as this community comes together to do the work. And the work deepens and enlarges the community. And you're becoming a different person. You're genuinely changing. And Communal Effort is just the most amazing podcast you'll ever experience. At least until the fifth season, which has a time travel subplot that I'm not really into. And okay, the 2020 season is just bizarre. I think the writers might have been drinking their own immediacy, if you know what I mean. But oh my God, even so, you've got to experience this podcast. And it's brought to you by the same production team who created the radical self-reliance burlesque and the network television phenomenon America's Got Gifting. So you know you'll love it. So enter the life-changing extended universe of the Communal Effort podcast. Season 1 is available wherever your volunteers are.
Thanks, Caveat. If we're going to make any collective communal effort together here, I think the lesson that's clearer than clear at this moment in human history is that my voice and voices like mine need to shut up and listen. Therefore, it's my pleasure and my honor to introduce my colleague and friend, Dominique Dubuquois-Dodley. He's the Senior Communications Manager for Burning Man and our Burning Man Live correspondent on diversity and radical inclusion. Welcome, Dom.
Thanks for having me here, and thank you for the introduction. I think it's a super timely topic, and I'm very happy to be here to talk more with some more friends of ours.
So who have you brought together for today's discussion?
I'm very happy to have good friends at this point who, over the last couple years, gotten to know on a work and, more importantly, a personal level. We have Elida Bautista here with us today. She will be joining us to discuss all manner of topics related to this bigger umbrella topic. She's the Director of Inclusion and Diversity at UC Berkeley Haas, the Haas School of Business in the Bay Area. I'm very excited to have you here with us today. We also have Aaron Douglas, who is joining us, I believe, from Maryland, and is the founder of an amazing initiative and community project called the Black Burner Project. Aaron, it's great to have you here, and I'm excited to talk with you a little bit more today. And we have Marlon Williams. Marlon and I have had some amazing conversations. He's the Assistant Director for Public Sector Innovation at Living Cities, is a fellow New Yorker, and is a fellow man of color and burner. I'm excited to have a really robust conversation with all three of you today and go into some of these topics. Well, I'd love to just kind of jump into this and start with something timely. Of course, it's no coincidence that we're having this podcast right now. This is a moment around the country and around the world where a lot of topics related to inclusion, diversity, racial justice, police reform are bubbling to the surface because of recent events. So I want to ask you guys generally, and zooming out a bit from the Burning Man community, what are you seeing in the present moment with the protests, with the fight for racial justice that you haven't seen before? What is making this moment feel unique? Or is there something that feels different about right now? I see a lot of chatter on social media and on the news that something has shifted here. What is that for you, and what are you seeing?
I think you're correct. At least in my lifetime, I haven't seen and felt such a shift. Even friends who themselves have said that they have had an internal shift. So I think that's something big in general. And seeing the diversity out there, the conversations that are being had, the acknowledgement in white people in general about their place in all this and their willingness to do the work. It's just different types of conversations and actions that are being had by people that I know are close to me. And far and wide, that is extremely different than what I've ever experienced before. And visually seeing who's out there supporting and in the streets and stuff like that is also, I think, different. It's not like we are just the ones fighting right now.
I'll jump in next. I think it's worth acknowledging that there are some things that are not different, right? Like, we have been having police brutality in our communities for decades, centuries, really, since the start of policing. You know, there was a moment of hyper attention and movements in the streets. The police killings have continued, right? Just here in the California, in the last couple of weeks, we've had in the Bay Area, two Latino young men were killed by the police. In LA, another young Latino man was killed by the police. We've had five Black men who were hung from trees. So there's a level of the violence that has been ongoing, right? That's not different. But to Aaron's point, what is different is the response, I think, potentially due to sheltering in place. Suddenly, folks are paying attention for the first time, it seems like, that are outside of our communities that might not have been directly impacted, suddenly have an awareness of that impact and of that impact on their colleagues or friends or communities. I think what's different now might also be the level of discourse, I think, is maybe more visible also because there's been the highlight of this wealth disparity. I come from the health sciences originally. There's been a lot of research, you know, a lot of my work for the last couple of decades was on disparities in healthcare access and treatment. But I feel like that's now part of the national conversation because of COVID, right? And how all of these structures are related in terms of institutional racism. It's the first time that I'm really hearing people. For a long time, I've tried to like get folks to be comfortable with admitting that we're all racist, right? That we all live and breathe this and have internalized it so that it's not about denying your racism, but rather addressing it. I think I'm finally hearing folks be able to name that and acknowledge that and therefore be able to work on it. So that's to me what feels potentially different about this moment than other times that we've been through this as a community and as a nation.
Thanks, Elida. I'd love to hear Marlon's perspective too.
Yeah, over the last month, my phone keeps blowing up with people asking me how I'm doing. And that's always like a hard question to answer as a Black man. It's like, how are you doing? The answer I settled on is same as it ever was, right? And that captures the trying to hold what has changed and what is the same. What has changed is that there are people reaching out and asking me how I was. That's not a thing that happened. But for me, the constant assault of hearing of another Black man who could have been me, like going out, taking a walk, doing something that should be a privilege of just being a person in the United States, resonates as like another brother down. And that just carries this weight. And I just kind of keep pushing forward because that is in some ways the only option that I have. I see the outpouring. I see the people who are there who are different than they used to be before. And I ask myself, what does participation in this community of people who are used to setting things on fire, what is the response of this community in a time when the rest of the world is on fire? Growing up, we're taught to fear fire. But what I've learned from going and participating in the burn is that sometimes you need to burn things down in order to create the space for the new. And when you do that, you actually create the fertile ground. You find out the things that survive because they are durable and resilient. And you find out the things that were holding you back from dreaming differently. I remember looking into the fire and you kind of start to see the possibilities of things that were never really there before. And so I'm trying to take that energy into the space and say, there is a new energy out there. How do we channel it? As a consequence of going to Burning Man, I became a fire dancer. And so one of the things I think about right now is that this energy is beautiful. It is bright. It is wonderful. How do we sustain this a month from now, 2 months from now, a year from now? How do you make it so it's not just something that has come into a moment and burns out, but it's actually an energy that can feel us forward into liberation? There's a part of my heart that kind of holds back in this moment, because I've seen people come out before and disappear a week later. I've seen people get angry before, and then once there's a call of normalcy, they go back to that. In a place where I don't really have the option to go back to normalcy, because normalcy never really worked for me, nor the people that I care and love. That is the fear that underlies my excitement. And I think there's a possibility of folks who are used to burning things down, who are used to destroying things, in order to make them come back together in a way that's more aligned with our values. There's an opportunity for us to really make that happen here. And I've also seen that opportunity be squandered. So I have to hold hope and I have to hold ancestral sense of disappointment and try to believe that maybe this time we can make something, if not completely different, at least push forward into the future we want.
Thanks, Marlon. You bring up a lot of important topics. It's a pretty good segue into where I want to take this conversation. For people who are just hearing your voices and your words now as a framework, the three panelists who we have here today, we've all done Burning Man Journal interviews together that are available on the Diversity and Radical Inclusion series, which you can find pretty easily on the journal. And we've gone deep on some of the topics that are important to each of these panelists as it relates to radical inclusion, Black Rock City, and the larger Burning Man community. And I think the starting point for that series was really to try to get some stuff on the record for people to reference down the line, not really knowing that we would be in this moment we are now. Elida was the first in the series. And I think back then, which is over a year ago now, who would have thought that we'd be sitting here talking about it in this context? But a lot of the messages are universal and have applied for a long time. One of the central themes is around what can burners do? And of course, that's a huge question for any topic, and it's no less broad and sweeping for the question around radical inclusion and racial justice. Zooming in a bit, I'm just going to briefly read one line from our interview to kind of tee you up to see if recent events have made you think a little more deeply. In our interview, Elida said, "If everybody really was practicing the virtues of Burning Man in their local place, they'd be figuring out how to include more voices in a way that isn't just about borrowing different music, but is actually about having people be part of a local community in a way that's participatory and isn't exploitative." I remember you said that in the context of a conversation around what burners can do and how people can shift their narrative. Can you give our audience a little bit more insight into where that feeling comes from and how it ties into what's going on now?
Sure. Thank you, Dom, for that. A couple of things come to mind right now, given where our nation is at and globally, really, that would be as relevant to burners. One is just to take the time to educate yourself. One of the things that has come out of this moment is a lot of resource lists, a lot of tree links. You know, there's an opportunity to have a better understanding without it having to be about burdening the few people of color you might know. And so take time to watch documentaries or read books or read op-eds, you know, listen to podcasts, whatever it might be. And take stock of who's in your network, who's missing. What are those ongoing relationships and narratives that you have access to that will increase your understanding? In terms of getting involved locally, well, when we think about the disproportionate impact that COVID has had on communities of color, the rates in Navajo Nation, for example, Native communities as a whole, in California, you know, it's Latinx communities, nationally, the Black community has been disproportionately impacted in terms of the rates of the disease and hospitalization, but also like unemployment and being those frontline workers and the vulnerabilities that come to that. And I would venture to guess that globally, since this is a global community, that's probably true about specific refugee populations in other countries or other marginalized communities that might exist in any given place. So folks can really think about who is being negatively impacted. How do I learn more about that community so that I can leverage my resources, my network, my positions of power, or whatever it might be to get involved? Here, one of the things that I think about in the Bay Area and that can be duplicated nationally is listen to or attend your school board meetings, your city council meetings. Lots of budgets are being passed right now. A portion of those budgets are considering, why do we have police in communities of color at disproportionate rates in the K-12? Should education budgets be funding police in schools? So listen in, call in. If you have an informed opinion, participate. If you don't, that's an opportunity to hear from community members what they've been experiencing for decades. In any organization that you're a part of, you can look at what are those budgets, who's getting funds, who are the vendors that your organization extends opportunities to, what are the policies in place around where you recruit for hiring, for example. Whatever network or circle you have, I think there's an opportunity to really think about where do you have influence and how do you leverage those resources to try to interrupt that negative impact that we're seeing disproportionately in communities of color.
And I think that that answer ties to a thread that all of us have discussed, and it's how do we take what we learn from the playa beyond that 1 week a year? And a thread that I think you've all gone deeper on, is that we do talk a lot about how Burning Man is more than 1 week a year, how it's a global year-round community and has been for a long time. But often there seems to be not a disconnect, but maybe more hesitation or lack of certainty around how burners can take the skills that they utilize in that 1 week and bring them out into the world. You've all shared that one major roadblock tends to be that people think they need to start a new thing. They need to go out and create a new nonprofit or be the founder of a new thing, where in reality, you may be able to just think about the skills you have and offer them up to the people who are already doing this work, who are the experts, who know. This, for me, feels like a moment where that's needed more than ever. I can't imagine that somebody as diversely skilled as the people who come to Black Rock City won't be able to find ways to plug in. And that's something that's really important to me. I'm wondering if there are concrete ways that you've seen that already happening, or if you have any suggestions for how people can take some of those burner skills and apply them to what we're seeing now.
The energy that we put into creating the city is one that's alive within each of us. The fact that we're not gathering this year, I think, is an excellent opportunity, because that energy is there and it needs to be channeled somewhere. And so where do we set up this magical city of dust? I say set it up everywhere. Figure out a place where you can connect where you are and try to put that energy into that place in creating moments of magic and creating moments of joy and reflection and connection. What I aim to do is to think of ways where you can show up humbly wherever you are, to see what's already going on. Do nothing for a moment, and actually the thing that you're doing is taking it all in. We talk a lot about immediacy. What would it mean, or what it would look like, to take immediacy in our own communities? To see who is there and represented there, and see who is not, and then figure out how can we be part of that communal effort? What gift do we have that we can bring to that space? And also be really cognizant and aware of the gifts that the folks who've been there before us have been putting into that space in those communities before.
Thanks, Marlon. Aaron, did you want to jump in on this topic?
You know, when I think of Burning Man and the energy that is there, why we love it so much is because it's so different from where we just came from, right? And so I think of community, I think of compassion and love and openness and kindness and all those things that we're seeing kind of like people butting heads with right now when it comes to some people who don't have compassion and people who aren't kind right now, or who aren't open to putting themselves in Black people's spaces and seeing what this is feeling like. If 70 plus thousand people are here right now and not only showing this stuff and giving off that same energy here, and then also like holding their own community and friends who are non-burners to that and teaching them, then we can make some major impact. I feel like there's more to it, but some of the most simple things that we do that creates the magic out there is missing right now in a lot of ways. I think we could have a huge hand in that.
Yeah, I would add to that there's the way in which we're used to dealing with so many things in our lives is by coming together. And this is like a point in the world where coming together is actually one of the more dangerous activities you can participate in. How would we figure out other ways of creating that? There were many ways in which Burning Man feels magic, but actually as a person of color, I remember my first year there, I was like, oh, I get it. This is just like church on a Sunday, but like with white people. And it's just like communal effort. Everyone's bringing your food. You're doing your things. Auntie's wearing her special hat like she does on like Easter Saturday. That's her self-expression, right? So there are ways in which all the things that we do and when we go to this place called Black Rock City, they exist out there in the default world. And Black Rock City is a way of putting a little bit of institutional culture around it. There's an organization and we get the permits, but like communities of color have been practicing joy as a form of resistance to oppression for our entire history. So that's in many ways the most profound way in which we can resist. And I think the ways in which Burning Man strives to be something radical, there's first never been anything radical that hasn't borrowed from the traditions of communities of color. They've been practicing it throughout this pandemic, throughout all of the things that have been happening. And so I think there's this opportunity for us to really be humble as a community of burners, to bring all those skills that you talk about and also recognize that like communities have been practicing this in a really beautiful way in the default world. And how can we join and be part of that so that we can truly have the process of lighting fires everywhere rather than it just being something that happens in the desert in Reno?
I think it's also worth mentioning that there already are structures within Burning Man too that folks can plug into as a way of being involved in responding in these various ways. Burners Without Borders, for example, has been having like weekly Zoom calls of various projects that folks can plug into to lend their skills and resources, right? Recently, I met Stephen, Ladies and Gentlemen, who is gathering volunteers to do MOOP cleanup following protests or following gatherings. And so that's like one way to show up that allows for folks to continue to practice their right to protest and march. And you can be like the backup cleanup crew, right? So that there aren't those kind of negative repercussions or whatnot. I also think about folks that have ranger training. I'll say, Marlon, I have been out in the I know we're not supposed to be, but just wear your mask, people. But, you know, I try to keep my distance when I'm out in the marches. But I think about if we had rangers that were on the perimeter that allow for people of color to be safe and to safely march and protest, and that they can kind of be co-conspirators in that way by using that skills and training to sort of hold the line. I don't know, I can't help but have this kind of Bay Area lens, but locally here, a lot of our Black-owned businesses were impacted by some of the earlier protests and marches with windows being shattered or things like that. And we have a lot of folks who have rebuilding skills. Maybe you approach a business and you ask them if they have any needs and lend some of your supplies or your hours to helping them physically put their space back together if that's a need. I think about the arts is obviously a very central aspect of how people come to Burning Man, to the event and to the organization. You know, people of color who are in the arts, who inform the arts, have the least amount of funding for their livelihood. So what are those opportunities to bring in folks into any arts projects or funding that you have? How might you partner and collaborate to center those voices and elevate those experiences in whatever form of expression that is? So those are some of the thoughts that I have about kind of specific tangible burner ways.
Thanks, everyone. I think that's a tremendous amount of useful information and perspective on this. And it's an evolving conversation. And I think hopefully people can hear that and find ways that they can identify with it and apply their skills that they've either had before being introduced to Burning Man or have learned since, because I think it's all applicable. Aaron, I want to go a little bit into your main project and one of the things that's taking up a lot of your time and energy right now, which is the Black Burner Project. We've talked about it a few times, and we're also trying to find ways to support the project. And not a lot of people realize it's just you. I know some people have said, oh, I want to support them. I love the stuff they're doing. And I remind them, it's just Aaron. So please keep it reasonable. She's just one person. You're holding a lot of space. It started as a call to have a group photo on Playa of people of color. And it's kind of turned into a bigger community support initiative, an educational platform, a media platform where you're hosting Instagram Live conversations every week. What's been one of the most interesting things you've learned in the process of building Black Burner Project to what it is now? And I'm curious to know what you're also still looking for. Is there something in your sphere right now that you wish you had more support with?
It started off just as a photo project, really. I didn't really know where it was going to go. I don't really know what I had a vision for. And the group photo didn't even come until that Wednesday of Burning Man. And so it was very small. And I knew that I just wanted to create a space where we could be seen and we could be found so that, you know, people could find us. You know, when I went and looked for inspiration or just to look up Burning Man, I didn't see anyone who looked like me, and it was hard to find someone to even talk to. And so the biggest thing that I found was how easy it is to just inspire and encourage someone just by showing representation. It's as simple as it took me showing someone of color for another person to be like, I'm totally in to do this now. And it didn't take much else. A couple, maybe a few other words, but for the majority of it, it was just like, I've been waiting to find something like this. I didn't know existed. I heard about it and I didn't think that it was for me, or I didn't think that I'd be accepted there, to relate it to just a general sense of the lack of representation and the impact it has on a negative sense, and the impact it has when it's actually done, is seeing that. You're right. A lot of people reach out to me and say, I want to be a part of this group, or tell me what the group. And I'm always like, it's just me. So, you know, hang on, you know, I'll get back to you at some point. So really, it's just, I've gotten a lot of great support from people. Every week, it's inspiring for me to get and read messages that people have, both Black and Brown burners expressing themselves of what this project has meant for them, and then white or non-burners of color who have said what an impact it is, or just supporting in any kind of way. So that's been super humbling, and I've met a lot of amazing people through that. And I know that I feel like that's the majority of what the Burning Man community consists of. So yeah, did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think you did. Thanks, Erin. And I'll just throw one quick follow-up on that. And I'd love to hear everyone's perspective on this. One of the taglines on the Black Burner Project site is simply, you belong here. And when you visit the site, that's prominently in front of you. And I think it kind of sets the tone for someone as they're navigating the site. And I'm curious to know from your perspective, why is that such an important line to have front and center? And then for the other panelists, how does the you belong here framing begin to shift the narrative a bit from what Elita first described as, yeah, we can claim that we're radically inclusive and that the doors are open, but are we actually setting examples and are we creating situations by which people feel welcome and invited in? So Erin, I'd love to hear where you belong here came from.
Yeah, I think when before the project even came to mind, it was just me posting photos that I was there. So I think it was just the idea that I, as a person of color, was someone that people could reach out to, you know, on Instagram, and they would say, hey, you're the first person that I know who I can ask questions. You know, like I said, they just all said the same thing. I didn't know it was for me. I didn't think we were allowed there. Will I be okay? It was pretty much the same phrase said over and over again. And so in that sense, in the sense of, yes, we can do these things. We do these things. You will have an amazing time. Not everyone has the same experience. I wouldn't want it to be seen as like, you belong here, as in you're not going to feel any kind of way out there as a burner of color, but you belong here in the sense that, from my experience and most people, you are welcomed there when you're there, and that we just do these things. There's this misconception that we don't do so many things and we hold ourselves in a box. And it's just like, no, we do these things too. You're welcome. And I want this space to encourage you to step into those fears and step into the spaces where we are few. And that, from my experience, I have felt welcome there. So that's where I took that and where why I wanted it to stay there for sure.
Thanks, Erin. I'd love to hear Elida's perspective, zooming out a bit from that. How do we begin to conceptualize the shift from just saying that we're an inclusive culture to being radically inclusive? I've heard you all express that part of that shift is to make the conditions by which people do feel welcome and feel like they're contributing and are part of this thing. What do you think about that?
I have a few thoughts. I'm trying to think of times that I've felt included and times that I've not felt included. My family has indigenous roots from a region in Mexico. And so I moved through the world as a brown woman having this particular identity. So the lens in which I come to Burning Man is from how that culture gets appropriated in different ways. And that's where I at times have a hard time being there. The other part of me is I've always been a weirdo, right? And I had friends from high school trying to recruit me to come to Burning Man since the mid to late 90s. And when I first moved to the Bay, it was the first thing everybody I met was like, oh, you're obviously a burner. And I was just like, nah. And, you know, I hadn't even crossed the gates where I was like, oh my God, this is so me. It speaks to my spirit as a person, my creativity, the things that appeal to me aesthetically. And then there's these moments of microaggressions where I'm like, ugh, because of the location and the significance of folks showing up in headdresses or having teepees. Anyway, it's obviously a bigger conversation. But I think that a lot of times when we're talking about inclusion or radical inclusion, people say like, well, it's open to everybody, you know, as Andy said in the introduction, or, well, that's not intentional. But I think the opportunity is to be intentional. Think about who is in your network, who is in your community. How are you forming relationships with folks based on common interests, right? Like the people that reached out to me were primarily not necessarily people of color, that they saw something in me that was like, oh, you clearly belong, as Aaron said. You clearly belong in this community, right? Like I wore wigs to go out. I dressed certain ways and kind of expressed myself in ways that folks were just like, oh, this is the obvious thing here. I imagine you're going to have people that you can connect with pretty easily, you know, whether it's political views or music or whatever it might be, and that that's the foundation for a friendship or relationship. And they happen to be a person of color, right? And you invite them, or you intentionally set aside tickets within your theme camp that are for people of color. Or, you know, if you have access to an arts grant, you make sure that a percentage of that funding is set aside and intentional, and you go out and you outreach and you form relationships with folks that you can bring into the fold by offering those resources. So I think there's a lot of ways in which it's really about intentionality and not pursuing somebody just because of the color of the skin, because that's weird too, but rather having an understanding that there's going to be some commonality and some connection that you can foster and then kind of bring folks in because of that.
Thanks, Elida. Marlon, I'd love to tee you up by just sharing with our listeners one quick excerpt from our interview and see if you want to tie your response into this. Marlon is eloquent when it comes to putting some of these concepts into spoken word. And one thing you said to me was, what is the primary privilege of whiteness? The privilege of whiteness allows you to be an individual while everybody else gets characterized by their race. Self-expression was always something really challenging for me because in my daily life in the default world, people always approach me and see me first as a Black man before any other data point gets to be expressed. Oftentimes, I don't have the opportunity with most people I encounter to go any deeper than that. With that as a framing, I'm curious, Marlon, if you can speak to some of what Elida spoke about and more generally how you're thinking about that topic.
Yeah, what's resonating for me right now is actually Aaron's quote, "You belong here." I'm remembering I arrived at the gates of Burning Man after a year where multiple men of color were killed, and I was just holding that really heavy in my heart. I get to the gates, and to the left of me, I remember there being this white woman dressed out in your typical burner wear, and they said, "Welcome home, you are beautiful." And she was like, "Yes, I am." And that broke my heart, because for me, when they said that to me, "Welcome home, you're beautiful," it felt like I realized that she had this experience all 365 days of the year. And I was coming as really an act of privilege to the space just to feel that for a couple of days, knowing that I wouldn't have that feeling anywhere else. It made it sweeter and it made it bitter at the same time. What I try to take away is, how do I transform that privilege into something that is a responsibility? I always talk about Black Rock City as a city built on privilege. I do this thought exercise where, like, imagine 70,000 Black folks said, like, we want to go out onto federal land, we're going to light some stuff on fire, we may be doing some illicit drugs and other things and be crazy naked. Here's our application. Can you please approve this? That's not going to happen. But that happens every year for Burning Man. We have this incredible privilege to be in the space to experience this thing. But privilege means nothing unless you use it to create more opportunity for other people, to create more joy, and to use your privilege to create spaces for others to be fully expressed. And so I'm thinking about, how do we take that and make sure that Burning Man starts when you leave? And in this space, this gap year that we have, or gap period that we have, how do we actually use it to rethink all the things we believe that we've known before? I look at the 10 principles, and for a long time, they were this beautiful guiding light of the values we wanted to espouse. But the more that I thought about it, the more I reflected and got deeper in my identity as a man of color, it's helped me understand that the principles as currently expressed aren't ones that I would have created, because it actually requires white privilege in order to think of radical self-expression as something to aspire to. For me, much of my life, radical self-expression, if I burn too bright, I get shot. That is the reality of my experience. And just the idea that self-reliance should be a principle is something for us to re-examine. What would it look like if we turned self-reliance into interdependence? Because everything in my life is really about how I live in community with others. There's so much about the experience that is transformative of going to Burning Man, but so many elements that are transformative are really survival techniques that I've experienced within my own communities back home. And what does it look like if we actually bring those out up front? So I'm not sure if you're asking for challenges, but I actually want to make a challenge to the community this year. Let's really look at the 10 principles, how they have been lived, and challenge ourselves to think more deeply about them. What parts of those still resonate and what doesn't? Leave no trace would be is something that we espouse and we speak to the world so much about. But leave no trace has this concept that you can actually go through the world and not impact it. That's never been something that I can't walk down the street and not have an impact. I try to be a good steward of those places in which I go through. How do I make them better? How do I honor that I don't own the things, but I have the responsibility to make them better for a time? If we transform that into how we think about our principles, how can we actually create the metamorphosis in our culture to make it one that not just speaks to the thing that happens out in the desert, but actually has resonance within the larger world and can expand beyond the communities in which we've had them to date? So that's one of my first challenges to our community. This is both to the organization, but our community is much more than the organization and the project itself. It's about people doing things in the places they are and everywhere. Let's use this time, instead of our migration being one of traveling to Black Rock City, but our migration be one that is more inwards and more spiritual and understanding how white supremacy lives in even the concepts of the city that we create. How can we deconstruct that and try to reform something that is actually closer to where we want to be, a place that like truly is radically inclusive for all?
Thanks, Marlon. I think so much of what you shared is tremendous, and I'm thinking about your comment around interdependence and my conversations about my experience at Burning Man with white friends and friends of color, and how those conversations go very differently when the part that I expressed about what was so life-changing or amazing about it and how people react to that. I've noticed that over time in some of the stories I hear, like you're kind of pointing out, for some white people, it's the first time that they've cooked a meal with a bunch of friends. It's the first time that they've sat around a fire and told stories about their lives. It's the first time that they've gone out and had interdependence as a feature of an experience specifically. But I then also talk to my friends of color, and they're like you're saying, it's like, yeah, that's what we do. What other way is there to live? And so maybe there's some education that can happen in a year where we're off. There's still a ton of work happening, of course, but where we're not gathering in the desert, maybe there's some energy that can be focused on looking to our local communities and learning from the experience of others. As we close out this conversation, I'd love to hear if Aaron and Elida also have a challenge for the community that comes to mind in a year where we're not gathering in Black Rock City. Marlon, you kind of teed that up pretty nicely. Is there something that comes to mind for Aaron or Elida that seems like a challenge to pose to the community or to the organization or both?
Yeah, I would say maybe a challenge is to make yourself uncomfortable. The playa is a place where we experience a lot of physical discomforts, you know, like the extreme weather and sand in your eyes and whatnot. I think this is a year to be uncomfortable emotionally because you're stretching and learning and growing and being challenged on what you thought was normal or okay or good. I think in the US in particular, for listeners who are burners in the US, you know, these ideas of democracy so inform how people with privilege can move through the world. And I say that as somebody who has other privileged identities. I'm straight, I'm cisgender. And so I think it's a good opportunity to, you know, if you're looking inward, as Marlon suggested, and doing that spiritual work, own some stuff and be uncomfortable and accept feedback and realize that as much as you think you're part of the solution, you are also part of the problem if you're not actively being anti-racist, anti all the isms in a proactive way, not just kind of skidding by.
Thanks, Elida. I'd love to hear your perspective, Erin, to close us out.
I totally agree with Elida. She said earlier about taking stock of who's in your inner circle. So it's about being uncomfortable, really diving deep inwardly, just like being out there on the playa kind of forces you to do, and really understand history, understand currently who you surround yourself with. And if it's not with a lot of Black and brown people, why is that? Not just to go out and talk to the ones that you know or to try to make a friend, but to really truly understand why you haven't surrounded yourself with more people of color and what that means and how you can start to widen your circle in a genuine way and really get to know people, I think is a big factor too.
Thanks, Erin. Guys, as always, we could talk for hours. We have talked for hours in the past about this topic, and I'm sure we will again in the future. For our listeners, if you want to hear more on their perspectives, please visit the Burning Man Journal. There are great pieces with all of their words for you to digest and for perspectives from other people on this topic, and we'll continue to contribute there. Huge thank you to take some time to speak to this audience, and I look forward to continuing the conversations with all of you.
Yes, really. Thank you guys so much for being here, all three of you. Thanks, everyone. That's our show today. Remember to follow us, like us, review us, and subscribe on your favorite platform. Our website is live.burningman.org, and you can find us at Burning Man Live on Facebook and on Twitter. The show has been a production of the Philosophical Center of Burning Man Project. Our executive producer is Daryl Van Ray, but really, it's also Stuart Mangrum. Our producers are Andy Grace and Logan Mirto. Our technical producer and story editor is Michael Vapp. Our liaison to the digital spirit world is Devin from the Internet. Our graphical guru is Tanner Boger. Our promotional spot this week was written by Caveat Magister. Our intro theme was cooked up by Jake Nizzle. And our correspondents are you. Please send your show ideas, letters, suggestions, and comments to live@burningman.org. And of course, donations are always appreciated at donate.burningman.org. Thanks, Larry.